This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So I think it's important to make a distinction between these kinds of intrusive thoughts that we're talking about and the kinds of thoughts arising in postpartum psychosis. So signs of postpartum psychosis can include mania, delusions, and hallucinations. And Action on Postpartum Psychosis are a great resource offering more information if you're interested to find out more. And of course, if you're having an overwhelming sense or intention to hurt yourself or your baby and making plans to do so, please seek help immediately by calling 999 or visiting your local A&E department.
Hello and welcome to another episode of But Why, the podcast that's all about digging into big questions and tricky topics by honest conversations. And this week we're going to be looking at intrusive thoughts, and I'm going to be talking to Dr. Caroline Boyd, who has over 10 years experience working in the NHS and mental health settings. And your I just want to say your CV, your qualifications and the array of practices that you're qualified in is unbelievably impressive. I feel like over time I've dipped my toe into quite a few different therapeutic practices and you seem to be able to do them all. So yeah, you're extremely qualified. She is also the author of Mindful New Mum, which is her published research explores mothers' experiences of intrusive thoughts and their babies. Her work's been featured in You Magazine, Grazia, BBC Radio Scotland and Women's Hour on Radio 4. Caroline specialises in supporting parents around difficulties related to anger and anxiety. So three important questions to begin with. How are you really? What star sign are you? And what's your favourite crisp?
So how am I really? First question. I am better than I was. It's half term for us and I wasn't feeling very well a couple of days ago. You know how it's as soon as you stop, you kind of get ill. But it was quite a fleeting virus, I think. And I'm actually feeling like I had a much better night's sleep last night. So I'm feeling all right today. Yeah, bonus.
Oh, thank goodness for that. It's so funny with half term. I always feel like they are actually put in at exactly the right time. The whole family begins to crumble, doesn't it? And you're like, we really need a reset. And then, yeah, lo and behold, hopefully you're all back on track a bit. Star sign and favourite crisp, please.
Star sign, I'm Aquarius. I don't know loads about star signs, but yeah, that's me. Recently had my birthday.
Yes, I know a bit about Aquarius. I've got two Aquarius in this house. Quite independent thinkers, generally quite popular, but actually quite like to beat to the sound of their own drum is my very quick summation of Aquarius. Can you relate to any of that?
I'm not sure. I think so. I mean, yeah, who knows? I had a chat with someone the other day and I said it was my birthday coming up and she said, oh, you're Aquarius. And I said, yeah. And she said, oh, they're really creative, aren't they? And I said, well, sometimes, other times less so. But yeah, I'll go with that.
Take it. And crisp? Favourite crisps?
So I would say I'm actually quite old school. I'm really like Frazzles every now and again. So that's kind of my old school favourite. And then now that crisps are like really have got a lot posher, I actually just like those salted kettles chips, you know, the ones that you can dip in hummus or, you know, whatever dip. Quite like those, quite partial to those.
I mean, my mind's stuck on frazzles and how great frazzles are. But they do get quite stuck in your teeth, don't they?
Yeah, but there's a very strong flavour, which is probably what is so appealing. Strong.
We've got some, we're on a, trying to save some money or recoup some money from doing a big reno. So we're on multi-packs of Aldi crisps at the moment. And we've got one which is frazzles, fake frazzles, Quavers and onion rings. I mean, it's phenomenal, but they are all extremely strong flavours.
Yeah, you can smell them about 2 miles away.
Yeah, they're always licking their fingers, but they are good. So we're here to talk about intrusive thoughts. And actually, for the listener, Caroline wrote for Mother of All Lists, wrote a post, which is one of the most kind of got one of the most traction that I've seen for a long time. And I supported that by doing a reel about, you know, the intrusive thoughts that I'd experienced in early motherhood about, definitely remember standing at the top of the stairs and thinking, oh, I could chuck my baby down. I actually often used to think as well, standing on a tube platform, oh, I could just push someone onto the tube tracks. And even as I say it, I feel terrible. But when I posted that, loads of people, just tons and tons of people are like, oh, I didn't know everyone else felt like that. And what do we mean by intrusive thoughts and how common are they?
Well, I mean, so my research and specialism is around intrusive thoughts in new mums, and we know dads get them too. But maybe just to zoom out a little bit, just speaking more generally, they in the general population, 85% of people get them. It's probably more, you know, our mind is awash with all kinds of thoughts, images, impulses, other flotsam and jetsam. And so, yeah, they're very, very common. And I guess, well, maybe it's helpful to give the example that I gave in the blog post that I wrote for you. But I remember when I went to New York with my husband, all pre-kids, and we were proper tourists. And I was doing, we were looking at the Empire State Building. And when we got to the top, I was kind of really, I had this really intense urge to jump off. And I had to, I remember kind of gripping the pane of glass, because it's, there's a, you know, glass where there's a guardrail. And, you know, as if to kind of tether myself, so strong was this urge. And it was kind of, I give that example because it's quite quite a good one for showing the characteristics of an unwanted intrusive thought, which is that, you know, firstly, that impulse, you know, clashed with my current flow of thought and mood. I was in a really good mood and enjoying chatting with my husband. And the second thing is that it was externally cued by, you know, being at the top of this enormously high building. And the third thing was that the more that I attended to and attached importance to that urge, the more intense it felt. So, you know, kind of responding to that urge, thinking, am I crazy for having that kind of urge? That's really weird. And then kind of thinking, you know, do I actually want to jump off? You know, so having that kind of response intensifies the unwanted thought. And we know that is what happens typically with unwanted intrusive thoughts that we all get from time to time. As I say, like 85%, possibly more of us get them. And what makes them intrusive is that they are generally, you know, attention grabbing, and they have some kind of emotional charge, and they tend to map on to whatever our current concerns are, and what we're doing at the time, which obviously makes sense. So yeah, they're very common, and with intrusive thoughts more generally, you know, I always say they tend to fly in the face of social convention. So generally the content is, you know, thoughts that are morally repugnant in some way. So examples, like you say, just then, you know, having an urge to push someone onto the tube track, you know, and I remember having thoughts like that, you know, when I was kind of in my late teens and really being quite scared by them. And so the point with intrusive thoughts that we're talking about is that they clash with our sense of self and our values. So they feel really at odds with us. And that's where the really strong emotions come in, where we feel that horror that we've had that thought, and we might feel fear or disgust for having that thought. So they are very, very common.
Yeah, and even the seemingly extreme ones. I mean, obviously, it goes without saying, I do not want to push anybody onto the train tracks, but, and you didn't want to do that jump, but it is scary, the idea, and with that sense of self, that it's come from my mind, therefore this is a reflection of me secretly being an absolutely terrible person. I think that's always where I ended up with it. It's like, oh, am I absolutely secretly a horrible, yeah, horrible individual?
Mm. Yeah. And that's where it's really the meaning that we draw from these thoughts that gives them power, when we interpret them to mean that we're somehow mad, you know, we're crazy for having this thought, or we're bad, we're inherently bad in some way.
And it's interesting, the example you gave and the context you gave about that trip is sounds like it was generally wrapped up with quite a positive time. And I know for myself, if something pops into my mind when I'm in a quite a good headspace, you don't attach anything to them. They're water off a duck's back, and they're kind of in and out of your mind as soon as they've happened. In fact, sometimes they can be quite laughable. But the exact opposite is true if they appear in the context of when you're otherwise struggling.
And we know that they are more likely in the context of feeling very stressed. And that could be external stressors, you know, thinking of the pandemic that we've just come through, not feeling supported, and feeling like you're struggling. And so, I would agree with that, absolutely. And I think that really comes to the fore when we're talking about these kind of thoughts arising in parenthood, which is an inherently very stressful time. You know, it feels, I think, for a lot of new parents, just like everything is happening all at once and your emotions can fluctuate. You know, you can feel sky high and then dip down low in the space of a single day sometimes in those early weeks and months. So it does also make sense that they come up then. And then also I think, you know, as I said before, the unwanted intrusive thoughts tend to map on to our current concerns and what we're doing at the time. And with a new baby, you know, as a new mum, you're hyper focused on that baby, you know, of course you are. So it's not surprising that we experience them in early parenthood and beyond.
Can you give an example of the mapping that you're referring to?
What the kinds of thoughts?
Yes, and how that, because that was one of my questions, is what is the purpose of them? And do you think that sometimes, A, they might not have a purpose, or B, is it a case that they're trying to shine a light on something?
Yeah. Let me just in case people are listening and they're just one, it'd be helpful to have a few examples of the kinds of thoughts. And then I'd go into, you know, well, why do we have these? So in the literature, there is actually not that much there in the research. But a leading researcher called Nicole Fairbrother, who's based in Canada, her team were the first to make the distinction between accidental unwanted thoughts of harm about the baby. So examples of those are, you know, having a mental image of dropping your baby down the stairs, or a word thought of, you know, my baby might suffocate. So those are really, really common, pretty much universal. And then the other type of unwanted intrusive thoughts are those of intentional harm. So examples of those might be having an unwanted impulse to throw your baby against the wall, to throw your baby out the window. And they are experienced by one in two new mums. So actually, that's a lot. It's a lot. And it's, I would say the likelihood is that actually it's more than that because of the worries around reporting these kinds of thoughts. It's likely an underestimation. So those are the kinds of thoughts that I'm talking about. And obviously they're experienced by new mums as really upsetting, and they can feel, you know, really paralyzing and destabilizing, particularly in this time when you're kind of grappling with adjusting to life as a new mum. You were asking, you know, well, why do we have these thoughts? And I think, you know, in a way, there's actually a few parts to what my answer would be for that. And I think the first thing to say is that what I found in my research and what's been kind of replicated in the larger studies is that we have these thoughts as a way of adjusting to the huge responsibility of having a child. You know, it's a huge, huge adjustment. And what came up in the research that I did, where, so my research was a qualitative study, and I did in really in-depth interviews with 8 women who were experiencing either accidental or intentional thoughts of harm about their babies. And they weren't being treated for depression, I should say, at the time. And what I found in my research is that these kinds of unwanted intrusive thoughts about their babies made them more conscious of their power and responsibility, in contrast to the baby's, you know, acute vulnerability. So there's something there about this precious and fragile baby for which we are responsible, which really creates kind of the emotional charge in these kind of unwanted intrusive thoughts. And I should add as well that what my research also showed and what my clinical work shows is that women grew more confident over time in their positions of power. And therefore, you know, these kind of unwanted thoughts reduced in intensity and frequency over time. So they do tend to fade in time, over time, once you know, through that adjustment. So I guess that's one part of that, the answer to that question. The other thing I think to say is just that in early parenthood, you know, our threat system is really dialed up. So we are particularly hypervigilant, you know, throughout a day. We've got so many anxieties, aren't there? You know, whether it's fear of external judgment or a self-critical thought about, am I good enough? Or a what if thought about our baby's safety. And our brain can't distinguish between a kind of life or death threat, such as, you know, stepping out into a busy road and there's an oncoming car, or a internal experience like an intrusive thought. So what happens is that we get the same fight, flight, freeze response coming up in our body. Our brain sends the danger signal and releasing all that adrenaline and cortisol. So we get the same physiological response to these intrusive thoughts. And so they feel very powerful, and we get that very strong, you know, that we get these strong emotions like the shame, the horror, the disgust that we've even had this thought. And then it can lead to, you know, if we do have that emotional response and then we make meaning of it where we interpret them to mean we're somehow bad or mad, then they become harder to dismiss, you know, and then we might, maybe we try to fight the thought, or we avoid things, tasks like, you know, it might be if we have thoughts about, worries about our baby drowning in the bath or something around bath time, then maybe we start avoiding actually bathing our baby. And that's where they can start to become more and more intrusive and upsetting, and it can become a bit of a downward spiral.
It's so interesting listening to you, and I don't think I know it implicitly, but I've never really acknowledged the one of the most challenging things about that chapter of your life is that your mind is trying to process so much, isn't it? Not only is it processing the day-to-day task of looking after a baby if you've never done it, every single thing in your life is having to be readjusted. And so it's just, you know, your body doesn't feel like it did. Your relationship probably doesn't feel like it did. Your day-to-day structure doesn't feel like it did. And we know it in every other part of our life. You know, if you move house, you expect there's some adjustment. Or if someone dies, you expect there's some adjustment. But in that bit, the adjustment we expect so quickly, but we don't really have the opportunity, I think, for your brain to do that. And of course, then it latches onto the what feels like a very acute thing, which is, look, I have got this one. I don't feel confident in myself or my sense of self, and yet I'm responsible for this tiny, fragile human. It's a huge thing to be working with, isn't it?
It is. And I think it's a really important thing to highlight, is that this transition is huge, and we have these expectations. And when I say we, I mean in Western culture, that, you know, modern mums should bounce back effortlessly and unsupported. When, like you say, we've had gone through these huge changes in our brains. We know that there are brain changes that occur starting in pregnancy, which also dial up that hypervigilance and that sense of anxiety, actually. So that is another way of kind of understanding these thoughts as kind of normal, if you like. So there's all sorts of changes in our brains, in our body, in our identity. And this is what I think Alexandra Sachs talks really powerfully about in the context of matrescence. And that's something, you know, that we need to honour and to really understand those changes and give ourselves time and grace to adjust. And I don't think society helps us do that when the structures aren't in place, I don't believe, to, you know, to really support new families. And I think the other thing is that we also have these huge pressures to parent perfectly. And, you know, this is where I'm talking about the myth of supermum, I call it, but some people think of it as the perfect mother myth. And it's really this idea that as mums, you know, and we get ideas about what the good mum is from a really early age, don't we? We kind of get this cherry pick version of all the good bits, which we internalize. And so our idea of the good mum, which also of course combines with our own experiences of being parented ourselves, but what it means is that our idea of the good mum is very much this, you know, idea that it's natural, and, you know, it's an innate ability, and that it should be emotionally straightforward, and that we're loving every minute. Mm. So it's this really kind of reductive idea of motherhood and this idea of being a good mum. And the problem with it, of course, is that it creates the idea that any negative feelings, mm-hmm, are not allowed. You know, we're denied those feelings that make us human. And so when we have a thought like an unwanted intrusive thought about harming our baby, perhaps on purpose, then there's this double whammy where, you know, we feel that shock and horror having the thought, and then we feel really bad about ourselves for having the thought, so we try to suppress it, and then it becomes this downward spiral. So I think it's also very particular, this experience of these kind of thoughts in the culture that we have, where the idea of the good mum is, you know, it discounts this experience of unwanted intrusive thoughts. It just doesn't have any space for it. So it means that when mums do struggle, they think there's something wrong with them. Yeah. And it's very damaging, I think.
Yeah. It's such a difficult thing to wrangle at first, that idea that I love my child, that I'm grateful to be a mother, but that I'm having a very, very hard time. And there's lots of this that I don't enjoy. And there's lots of, you know, I remember the first time I ever thought, questioned whether motherhood was the right choice. And, you know, 10 years down the line, it was 100% the right choice. But of course, when everything you know has changed, it's very normal to think like that. But yeah, the idea that, well, I think it's actually a bigger picture. I had Alain de Botton on the podcast, and he's just like, the idea of happiness is such a falsehood, you know? That is, life is not happy. There are moments of happiness. There are moments of joy. But essentially, life is a mixture of all of those things. And as with everything, parenthood is like the most reduced, potent version of the picture of life, isn't it? And I think that, as you say, that is the bit that can be such a roller coaster. You can go out, you could have been having a great day, and then it can be taken away from you, or you can still feel lonely. But that's just life.
Yeah, absolutely. So these kind of thoughts in that context do feel very jarring. And I think it's important to say, perhaps at this point, that, you know, the very fact that mums will have that strong emotional response, you know, feeling that fear, that horror, that disgust, and then, you know, the guilt and the shame, is a strong sign that she's very unlikely to hurt the baby. So, you know, research does show that in the absence of other risk factors, having these kind of thoughts makes a parent no more likely to harm their baby. And in fact, the most recent research by Nicole Fairbrother's team, which was published last year, showed that women who reported unwanted thoughts of intentional harm towards their babies are actually slightly less likely to hurt their babies. That research needs to be done on a wider scale to be, you know, to get the kind of the significant finding, because it was a smaller sample. But it's, you know, I think it's obviously very encouraging. And I think that it's important for us as professionals as well to be able to sensitively assess as to what kind of intrusive thought a mum might be having and the emotional response to that. And then, of course, the wider context, you know, needs to be considered as well. So if a mum does state intention to hurt her baby, and or has a previous history of hurting her baby, then of course the risk needs to be taken seriously. But I think actually with the kinds of unwanted intrusive thoughts that we're talking about, they don't mean that a mother poses a risk to her baby. So I hope that's reassuring for some of your listeners today, just to understand that. And I've got an infographic on my blog that I shared from Nicole's team, which walks you through what are intrusive thoughts, what are unwanted intrusive thoughts in the context of parenthood, and actually the greater risk is OCD because of this emotional response around these kind of thoughts, and possibly also the lack of understanding. But we know that 17% of women are diagnosed with OCD in pregnancy and postpartum. So we really need to be, you know, very thoughtful about how we're assessing these kind of thoughts and the support that mums get when they report these kind of thoughts. And just to add that what we're talking about today in terms of unwanted intrusive thoughts about the baby, are these kind of thoughts are distinct from the kinds of thoughts that might occur in postpartum psychosis, which is a more rare condition, which involves mania, hallucinations and delusions, where if, you know, the mother having a psychotic thought, it doesn't clash with her sense of values and her sense of self in the moment in the way that an unwanted intrusive thought does. So maybe it's important to make that distinction as well.
So almost, if I'm right in saying, if you're horrified by your own thought, that's actually quite a reassuring barometer that that it is an intrusive thought. But I mean, you're so right. It's that reaction to yourself is the bit that feels so powerful, doesn't it? That's the bit that also, importantly, I think people stay silent about. Again, in the work that you've done and when I've shared your work, it's that huge relief that people get that it's not just them. And often in early motherhood, it can be quite an isolated experience. Often your peers who are having babies, the chances are, unless you're very lucky, they aren't your good friends. So you don't feel comfortable enough to say, oh, I thought this last night. Or if you haven't got, you know, in the more traditional sense, that village around you, for someone to say, actually, don't worry about it. We've all had those thoughts. It begins to fester. And earlier you touched on something that I definitely related to in terms of anxiety, where for a period, I got really anxious when I got on the tube. And then in order to get on the tube and make it okay, I'd be like, oh, I'll get water and chewing gum and then it'll be okay. And then I became anxious about whether I could get water and chewing gum. And suddenly what was occasional bit of anxiety on the tube became extremely debilitating. And I think that is the bit that you want to try and stop before it begins to spiral, isn't it?
Yeah. And thank you for sharing that. And I can sort of understand how that response of kind of wanting, you know, it's kind of similar, isn't it, to a response where if you're having unwanted intrusive thoughts about your baby stopping breathing, then you might really increase the amount of times you check on them in the night. You know, it's a kind of perhaps a similar thing. And yeah, I think early identification, if you like, is really, really key. So I think one of the things that I really recommend for women and men too, because we know that dads get these kind of thoughts, is to talk to someone, to talk to a loved one, someone supportive, a mum friend who gets it as a first step. And also to talk, if you feel like these kind of thoughts, that you're really struggling with them and they're getting in the way of everyday life with you and your baby, then, you know, please talk to your GP or your midwife or your health visitor if you have a good relationship with them, because, you know, that talking with your GP, their role is really to understand the context for you and to get you the best support that you need. And I think, you know, women have contacted me on Instagram and said that the response they've had from professionals has been variable, and in some cases it's been really unhelpful, where sharing these thoughts, unwanted intrusive thoughts, has been responded to with a kind of knee-jerk reaction, and, you know, in some cases involving social services because of a perceived risk to the baby. So that's where I think Nicole Fairbrother's research, which I mentioned earlier, becomes really important. And I share on my website kind of steps for speaking with your GP about these kind of thoughts, you know, talking with someone first and thinking about what examples you might want to share that you feel comfortable with. But the point of talking with someone else is that it gives you a chance to process these thoughts and to make sense of them and to understand, you know, that you're not the only one that gets them, and they don't mean that you're mad and they don't mean that you're a bad mum, and to understand how common they are. And actually, with, you know, you asked at the beginning, like, why do we get these thoughts, and actually understanding them as part of the adjustment to the huge responsibility of having a baby, we can understand them as a bit like an effective warning system. You know, if you imagine, you know, having your newborn and they're so tiny, and when you're, you know, a new mum, you may never have held a baby before. You know, that's the case for some people, or you may have done, but not for a long time. So they feel quite fragile. And imagine that you go somewhere where you're up high, and you have a worry thought of, what if I drop them? You know, if you imagine on a balcony and you have this worry thought, what if I drop them? So you, what do? You take three steps back. Then also imagine you're on that balcony and maybe you have an urge to throw your baby off. I would say, what do? You probably grip your baby tighter. So there's a real sense of, you know, they're teaching us in a way to protect our babies and to take care at a time when, you know, we're feeling very tired. And so they are understood as adaptive. And it's actually how we respond to them that is the important bit. So, you know, the more that we attend to them and attach importance to them or think that actually that it means we're going to act on them, the louder they'll get and they'll increase in power and intensity. So actually what we want to do is to try and find ways to separate ourselves from these thoughts, you know, to notice them. So kind of to bring in those mindfulness skills around noticing these thoughts and, you know, focusing inwards and noticing them with kindness and kind of bringing the context, you know, okay, so this, you know, I'm feeling really tired at the moment, you know, maybe I'm just feeling really vulnerable at the moment and I'm getting these kind of worry thoughts. Maybe this is a sign that I need more support. And I would say that's the case perhaps for some of those unwanted intrusive thoughts that mums might have in the middle of the night, you know, after multiple wakings, feeling absolutely exhausted. I know that mums have described having unwanted intrusive thoughts of intentional harm because it's, you know, you're talking about a mum in the middle of the night having all those not allowed thoughts and feelings. And we never actually really talk about what goes on in a mum's head in those moments. But maybe if we think about it for a moment, you know, in those overwhelming moments, your baby's crying and crying inconsolably, it seems. And we know that the baby crying for long periods is a very obvious, understandable trigger for having an unwanted thought of intentional harm. And so a mum is more likely to have, in that over, moment of overwhelm, an unwanted impulse to throw her baby out the window. So in that moment of overwhelm, you know, that mum has gone into threat mode. Her emotional brain has taken over. Her thinking brain has gone offline. And if she perceives herself unable to cope and soothe her baby in that moment, you know, and maybe she's just been scrolling through Instagram and seen posts of perfect mums with their perfectly behaved, smiling babies, then that's going to be playing into those that moment too. Then she may well be then thinking, this is too much and I can't do this. So she loses the context and she loses the, you know, by the context, I mean the ability to kind of create a bit of mental space between that impulse and that moment of overwhelm to just remind herself, oh, my baby's teething, or I've had a really long day, and to just bring the context to that moment. So what is important here is how she responds to that impulse in that moment of overwhelm and how far she understands what's being triggered in her in that moment.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
And again, you know, as I said before, context is really important. And these, if you're having thoughts and impulses, you know, these unwanted thoughts and impulses a lot, and these moments of overwhelm are happening a lot, then they can be a really helpful sign that we need some extra support. So that's something I think is just helpful to add. And then in the moment to just, I would recommend for that, you know, mum in the moment of overwhelm to put her baby down safely if she can, or to hand over to a partner if she has one, and to step away for a few minutes to self-regulate, splash her face with water, focus on her breath if she can. And then she'll be able to, through doing that, bring her thinking brain back online again and be able to kind of connect with what are the feelings underneath that impulse and those fears, you know, I can't do this. And what are the unmet needs? You know, is it a need for more support? Is it a need for feeling validated and understood? You know, it could be lots of different needs there that aren't being met for her. So yeah, I hope that's helpful, just to add that these kind of thoughts can be helpful to explore and to make sense of, and sometimes with the support of a professional, sometimes not.
I think it's so useful. And in my experience of various mental health challenges, and most specifically with anxiety, but I feel like these are quite closely related. Actually, for me, the moments that felt like the very bottom, you know, the moment when I did first seek professional help, ended up being the beginning of moving towards something else. It's kind of accepting that I'd reached my limits. And in the case of anxiety, actually, I look back and it's, when it was acute, is because there's a lot of things going on in my life and because of lifestyle choices that I was making. And similarly with this, if you ask yourself with kindness, why might my brain be putting out these signals? Because of all the reasons we've already talked about. And actually, if what feels like, as I say, the bit that is, this is unimaginable, why am I like this? If that is the impetus to finally say, somebody help me, let me go and sleep in another room tomorrow night, then yeah, weirdly, they are so often the turning points to getting help. And I always feel inclined to press upon people in my worst moments postpartum and in my worst moments of anxiety. I couldn't imagine how these things would ever change. And I was like, this is who I'm going to be now. That was always the narrative. Oh, maybe I'm secretly a bad person. Maybe I'm now an anxious person. But there is always a way out of these things, isn't there?
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you mentioned that sometimes, you know, we've talked about having these unwanted intrusive thoughts and they're, you know, and the meaning we attach to them, giving them power. And then we've also talked about when they can be a sign that actually we've reached our limit and there is unmet needs there that need attending to, and maybe we do need more support. But actually that can be, yeah, I mean, it's, I think what I try to talk about with the women I work with and really encourage, and I think came out in what you were saying, is that those are the times when we are most deserving of help and support. And, you know, we can get very caught up with these stories that we create about ourselves and those fear-based self-limiting beliefs of I'm a shit mum, or I'm an anxious person, you know, and it can be really transformative, actually. And this is, Tara Brach calls this kind of process that you're talking about beautiful monsters, because it's monstrous, because it's so, can feel so destabilizing and so distressing. And at the same time, you know, it's beautiful because actually these are times when we learn more about ourselves and we become more in touch with ourselves, and we get to know our internal world and to understand more about, you know, the kinds of thoughts that we might be having and the feelings underneath them, and, you know, those ways to redirect attention as well, which is why I think mindfulness skills can be really helpful in that, you know, and how to focus attention away from certain thoughts that just aren't serving us.
No, it's so true. And I think, like, being kind to yourself is thrown around so much that sometimes we don't hear it, but you really do have to offer yourself kindness. And a very small thing, but I think it's so powerful, that took me a long time to understand, you can leave the room, you can take yourself away, and that isn't failure. And it's amazing, you know, not with a newborn baby in the middle of the night, but so often I advocate for going for a walk around the block if you can possibly find the way to do that. And just that 10 minutes of reset is transformative. But when you're in the depth of it, you just get pulled down and down and down. But yeah, walking away and giving yourself time out is such a huge tool.
It absolutely is. And I think, you know, God, I mean, we could talk another conversation, but just about how the emphasis really is, I think, on the baby and, you know, our models for understanding child development and this whole adjustment are very child-centric and focused on the baby, which is, of course, hugely important. And I advocate for the baby in my work, of course. At the same time, it's so important that we allow the mother to honour her own needs, because, you know, her needs are interconnected with her baby's, and they need attending to as well. So like you say, you know, if anyone's listening and you've had a terrible night of broken sleep with your baby, maybe your two-year-old or your five-year-old, and you've had to leave the room and you've had to step away to regulate yourself, it does not mean that you're bad. It doesn't mean that you're failing. It means that you're taking the steps to look after yourself so that, you know, that so that you can come back together with your baby and repair if you need to. And you can mother in the way that you would like to, in line with your values and your authentic self. So I think that's a very powerful thing to emphasize. Mm.
And I love the bit that you referred to with your thinking brain, because I think that is the other bit that's destabilizing about early parenting. I was like, I just feel like I couldn't get to that version of me much at all. Or maybe I'm reflecting badly, but it's really difficult to get to that. But you're in survival mode basically for a huge chunk of time, and that's not something we're used to. So of course it's hard.
Mm. What do you think helped, if it's all right to ask?
What was the transition?
Yeah, what sort of helped you get more in a sense of your own identity as a mum that kind of fit for you?
I think it's a really good question. I think that moving away from, I don't know if it's controversial, but I think I had a version of motherhood that was a lot about service. And whereas as I began to be able to prioritize my needs a bit, I don't know, I'm struggling, because I think it's such a long journey, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, I can reflect on the baby days with relative confidence now, because I've done it three mm-hmm. times and I'm this far down the line, so I've been able to reflect and learn. But I'm aware that I'm going to have to parent teens soon, and I will go back into that bit of not necessarily knowing what I'm doing and my triggers being set off and my children feeling frustrating. And, you know, so I can't really answer that question other than to know that I fully believe in that putting your own oxygen mask on in order to parent them better. Yeah, without doubt. There's a young quote, which is, there's no greater damage to a child than a mother's life unlived. Or I've misquoted that, but
no, I think that sounds bang on. And I think, yeah, I think it's really powerful what you just shared, because actually it is about learning to prioritize our own needs, but that can feel very unfamiliar and uncomfortable in a culture where women, and from the age of when we were little girls, it was about being, you know, self-sacrificing and nurturing and caring and ultimately putting others' needs above our own. So it does feel like it goes against the grain. And I think this is where becoming a mother can be really transformative, because actually it also involves, and obviously this is a process, a lot of unlearning around certain beliefs about ourselves, and as you were saying, developing a kinder relationship with ourselves and also therefore our thoughts. So I think that kind of really is at the heart of certainly my frame for motherhood, is is learning to do that. And I think it's a work in progress for all of us, and understanding. I really like the idea of understanding parenting as in terms of seasons, you know, and matrescence again is really helpful for this. It's an ongoing process. It's not only when we become a new mother, but when there are different stages and, you know, like you say, moving into parenting teens, you know, and just being, well, I think it comes back to self-awareness, doesn't it? And just really attending to your own feelings and needs and what's being triggered in you in that process, mm-hmm. and just continuing to attend to that as well as what's going on for your kids. And it's all done imperfectly.
I think, you know, at the point that I became a parent, I'd always tried very hard at everything that I'd done, you know, worked well at school, gone to uni, got a career, like real good girl behavior, which is mm-hmm. fine. And then when you realize that you can't kind of ace parenting, you can't, because it's so multifaceted. And or if you can ace parenting, what's happening to your sense of self? And again, I think it's Alain de Botton or the School of Life have talked a lot about the good enough parent. You know, I'm trying to give my kids veg, I'm trying not to let them be on screens all the time, I'm trying to make them be decent people. But then again, of course there are days when they just eat beige food, and there are times when they are on the screen more than I'd like, and that's okay, you know.
And that is okay. And that is the good enough parent, which I think for some people it feels, you know, especially when we've had all those good girl narratives, it can feel when we first hear it, or when it first comes up, it feels a bit like, well, that feels like I'm settling. Mm. Whereas actually it's understanding that the good enough parent is, you know, attending to her kids' needs as far as she can. And of course, you know, she wants to be their secure base and provide that safe haven, you know, all to give that child a sense of secure attachment. And at the same time, she's not a saint. She does have limits. She will mess up and make mistakes. And that is also really important for her child's development, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, and we know that only even the most attuned mums only get it right a third of the time. So, you know, we've just got to give ourselves grace.
What a relief. But to go back to, like, really acutely to the intrusive thought things, it's like we know that other people are thinking this, and rest assured that other couples are arguing in the middle of the night, and rest assured that every mother has thought, why on earth have I done this, or rolled their eyes at having to go to the playground, or found playing with a kid really boring doesn't mean you don't love them. It's like none of us are doing this in the angelic way that we thought we should be doing it.
No, and nor should we be. And that idea of the perfect mum that you might, you know, we've all internalised, you know, I sometimes talk with clients, you know, would you want to be friends with them? You know, being perfect is not what it's about. So like you say, being human, you know, bringing our own imperfect selves and showing up where we can. And also, because these things can be mutually true, attending to our own needs and connecting with our identities in a way that in ways that we need to, because that will bring a wholeness to our sense of self, and that will be helpful for our children too, as well as for ourselves.
Well, this is it, and I think we want to raise kids who, like, prioritize themselves, but above all, who can ask for help when they're struggling. You know, if I wanted to give one gift to my kids, it would be to know that I love them when they're anxious, when they're feeling like the worst versions of themselves. And it always comes back to this, but the only way that they can learn that is to see us model that.
Absolutely, with all our vulnerability, because we all have it.
Yeah, I laugh. I think my kids really definitely get to see all of the things that are me, and I'm absolutely fine about that, you know. And I am very confident in saying to them, I can't do this with you now because I've got to do this. I love you and I will when I can, but I've got to go on exercise, or I've got to do this. And none of that is a reflection of you. And yeah, and I hope that they learn those boundaries too, but we'll see.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, you're modeling the things that are important to you, and, you know, and they will pick up on that, and they will also develop their own interests and the things that are important to them, and hopefully invest time and energy into that in line with their values. So I think it's, you know, it's all good stuff.
Yeah.
And I would say, just on intrusive thoughts, you know, anyone who's listening and feels like they're struggling with their thoughts, please do talk to someone and ask for help.
Yeah.
And, you know, chances are it can feel like you're taking a bit of a risk to share it with a mum friend. At the same time, you know, it's, you're more likely you will find that they've had similar experiences, given how common they are.
Going back to where we began with, like, online stuff, every single time I go to share something that I feel is weird and a little bit, I put it out, and it's always the stuff that kind of gets the most traction. And there is nothing like that feeling when someone goes, oh yeah, me too. Me too.
Yeah.
Me too. It's like, oh, what? This thing that was my, like, thing that I thought was weird or bad or strange. Oh no, it turns out you're all doing it. And it's just the most, yeah, relieving feeling, isn't it? It's just what makes us human.
Exactly. And I think it provides huge relief to understand that you feel, yeah, to have your experience shared and to feel that you're not being judged in that. Someone's like right alongside you in that.
Yeah, it's all the things we know, and Brené Brown talks about it a lot. You know, the courage of vulnerability is the bit that really can cement some amazing friendships in this space as well.
Mm.
Two questions to end. Where can people find you, and also give a good old plug to your brilliant book?
Oh, so I'm on Instagram @_, sometimes people forget the underscore, but it's @_DrBoyd. And my book, Mindful New Mum, A Mind-Body Approach to the Highs and Lows of Motherhood, is available in most good bookshops, I think. So, yeah, I think that's probably
a good place to
best thing to say about that.
And my second question, which is always a whopper, my last question, if you could have an honest conversation with one person, who would it be and what would you say?
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh, well, gosh, what a famous person.
Take it as you like. I've had all kinds of answers to this question.
I mean, I'm thinking of people like Razika Parker and Adrian Rich, who have written so honestly about motherhood. So I think I'd want to have a conversation, I think, with one of them and learn from them and hear their experiences. So maybe that. I'll go with that for now, I think.
Yeah, I'll go with that. It's so interesting, again, being kind of several years down the line and on the digital thing, but also in parenting, and like how the narrative has changed from when I began in this. And no, it felt like nobody was talking honestly about parenting. And then I wonder whether we're in a new wave where, I don't know, it's fascinating, the journey of this, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I think there is a lot more talk on platforms like Instagram, honest talk about parenting and, you know, experiences that don't fit with the perfect mother myth. And that is incredibly helpful, and kind of, I guess, alternative stories of motherhood, which is really, really helpful, and was partly why I wanted to set up on Instagram, was to be part of that conversation, because I think it is a really, really strong, powerful platform. You know, a lot of parents are on it, and as a way of sharing psychology insights and, you know, stories of motherhood and experiences of motherhood that ultimately help parents feel less alone and less ashamed in their experiences. And then at the same time, I think, you know, we know about social media, the thinking about the light and the dark of it, is that, of course, you know, the research, I think, consistently shows that detrimental impact it has on our mental health, and actually how those kind of curated feeds that really reinforce the some of those messages around the perfect mother myth and the supermum myth are just incredibly unhelpful. So I think it's kind of both and, isn't it? And I think it does mean more countering those myths and to continue on. And, you know, I first set up on Instagram to share my research findings around unwanted intrusive thoughts with the knowledge that, you know, my research was published in a journal, and parents don't, you know, they don't tend to, people generally don't tend to read journal papers, perhaps least of all tired new mums. So I wanted to share that information to parents in a helpful, accessible way. And that's what inspired me to set up on Instagram. I think it's a constant dilemma, I suppose, about how to engage with social media in a way that feels helpful, but also helpful for, you know, me as a therapist, for you as a very kind of high profile voice, so that you don't get too wrapped up in or caught by the darkness of social media.
That's it. You've exactly touched on the thing that I can't quite wrangle. I feel proud, and, you know, I know why this journey has unfolded, but I also ask if it was the right one, if it shifted some narratives in a different, and again, this is a whole different conversation, but less around the super mum, but around the idea of marrying a career and motherhood, and that it, you can do it all, and that you can, you know, make a profession of motherhood, which is definitely ill-advised for so many reasons. Instagram has helped me hugely, but I think if I'd have had it as a new mum, I think lots of it would be very confusing. And you said earlier about we've got all these things coming at you when you're a new mum. If all the different messages in social media were coming at me when I first started out on it as a mother, would it have added to it? I don't know. There is no answer. I guess it's going with it, with that acceptance that we've only learned on the go with social media, as we have with parenting. But I wonder whether we'll look back and go,
Well, I think we are still learning. I mean, I think there's a lot of learning to happen, and a lot more, I think, needs to be put in place to, I'm thinking about porn now. So, you know, that's getting off topic a bit more, but of course it's related. But in terms of what is impacting, you know, behaviours around or understandings of sex for young people. But that's a slight aside, I suppose. But I think it comes back to self-awareness and boundaries, and, you know, an understanding how powerful actually the media and social media can be, and just being really as thoughtful as we can be about how we engage with it. So I would say, you know, for parents who are experiencing unwanted intrusive thoughts of harm, and we know that the majority will at some point, given how common they are, if you're experiencing them in a way, you know, these are anxiety driven thoughts, if you're experiencing them in a way that feels very destabilizing, and they're really, you know, you are getting into a bit of a downward spiral with them, and that can happen. And this is why I was talking about, you know, reaching out for help and sharing your thoughts with someone that you trust to help with that process, to get you the support that you need. But I would say for a mum who's experiencing them in that way, then just to steer clear of social media. You know, it's likely not going to be helpful for someone feeling very anxious, because there is just so much out there. There's so much conflicting, confusing information. And so I think, yeah, just keeping clear of it for the time where you're feeling anxious is probably advisable.
Do you know what? I had Gemma Stiles on the podcast, and we talked about social media, and she just gave a great analogy. If you're feeling a bit vulnerable, a bit tired, a bit anxious, you wouldn't go into a room with several hundred or several thousand people that you didn't know and try and get their opinions on something to help yourself out. Like, that is, it's so obvious. If you're feeling a little bit like that. You go, you shut that door and you go and have a cup of tea with someone in real life that you know. And I think we really have to remember, although it's digital, it is the equivalent of throwing yourself in that. And then on another day when you're feeling confident and extrovert and you want to go on, yeah, socialize with people, go on there, but try and boil it down to quite a real life version like that. And it's so obvious. Yeah, I'm feeling hormonal and a bit insecure. Yeah, you're not going to want to go and hang out in the lion's pit of many people. It's so true. Anyway, I'm very aware of time. Thank you, Caroline. This has been everything that I hoped it would be. Yes, I feel like I've got a bit of a free therapy session out of you, which is really fantastic.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear it's felt helpful. And thank you so much for having me on. It's been a complete pleasure to talk with you.
That was a really interesting episode. I remember when I first came across Caroline and her work, and also when she first wrote for Mother Allis, I just really, really wished that I'd had access to it when I first became a mum. I'm wondering if I had any intrusive thoughts before then. I've got a vague recollection of maybe having them as a teenager, which would make sense. It's another massive time of transition, a lot going on, lots of hormones. But I feel like it comes up a lot with the subjects we talk about, but particularly with this one. As she said, this is so normal. Those weird thoughts you have, somebody else has had a version of them. Often, you know, maybe someone next to you in the post office queue, or also at the top of, what monument was she? Oh, the one in America. Anyway, the point is, don't feel traumatized by your own mind. It can do stuff that feels shocking or weird, but it's much more normal than you think. And I really want to press upon the point that if this has happened often, it is a signal that maybe you have reached your capacity, that maybe you need to seek help. And I always think, if any of the people that I love were feeling like that, I'd hate the thought that they didn't think that they could reach out, whether that be my sister or a friend or anyone. So do reach out. There is such power in allowing people to help you. And there's a power in knowing what your capacity is and being vulnerable. But more importantly, it will be all right. Things will work themselves out. So that's that. Thank you so much for listening. That's another episode of But Why Done. So, so grateful to have you here. Please join me next week for more honest chats. And in the meantime, rate, review, subscribe, share it with your mates. It all makes a huge, huge difference. Or come follow us on @butwhypodcast on Instagram. I am now off to do some dusting. I am always dusting, but this house is always dusty. There's a real problem if you do a big renovation like we are doing. You get some rooms that get finished, but while other rooms aren't finished, they are constantly filthy. I've got a lovely bathroom, the kids' bathroom, which is checkered. In fact, you can find us at The Forever Home on Instagram. It's a beautiful bathroom, but already the grouting is filthy because it's had builders and dust ingrained into it, which is pretty depressing given that it's brand new. Anyway, first world problems. Wishing you a good day. Catch you next time. Bye-bye.